in these trying times. Please stay safe, and together we will grow a more compassionate community. Hi, this is Ray Lager, Underwriting Director at KZFR. In these uncertain times, one thing is for certain. You have to reach out to inform the public of any changes in your business or organization. If you'd like to be represented to our thousands of weekly listeners, please contact me at underwrite@kzfr.org or call or text me at 520-4742. That's 520-4742. I'd love to share some information about how KZFR can help you in these trying times. Please stay safe, and together we will grow a more compassionate community.
Hey there, Butte County. Jason Cassidy here, interim editor of the Chico News and Review. Thanks so much for tuning in again to this new weekly program, which airs every Thursday, 5:30 p.m., right after the Butte Report with Sue Hildebrand here on KZFR 90.1 FM and KZFR.org. As those who've already tuned in know, this show is a radio version of the print Chico News and Review, the new issue of which hit the racks last Thursday and is still available all over Butte County. For now, the print paper is monthly, but you can find more Chico News and Review stories online, along with our community calendar and county and state COVID updates, as well as a link to sign up to the paper's weekly email newsletter, all at chico.newsreview.com. And the Chico News and Review show will be taking the next two holiday weeks off, so...
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley. Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Stay tuned for the Butte Report. The Butte Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. For more information, call Cotton Party at 893-4923. Tonight we cover the Chico Unified School District, the Oroville City Council, the Oroville Elementary School District, and the Chico City Council, including interviews with Sharon Nilsson, Oroville Elementary School Board Member, outgoing Oroville City Council Member Linda Draper, and Chico City Council Member Alex Brown. Last Friday, the Chico Unified School District met for over 5 hours at the Pleasant Valley High's Center for the Arts. The meeting included the swearing-in of new trustees, the election of board officers, and a lengthy discussion about the reopening strategy after the new year. Caitlin Dalby and Matt Tennis were sworn in as the newest trustees. After that, Eileen Robinson was chosen as the new board president, and Kathy Kaiser was chosen for vice president. Tom Lando was chosen as clerk. Then the issue of reopening after the new year was discussed at length. Finally, in a 3-2 vote, the board decided to continue with the current AM-PM schedule to start the spring semester, and then during the scheduled February 3rd meeting, the board would reassess and consider a full reopening of the district. Caitlin Dalby and Tom Lando voted against the plan to continue the AM-PM schedule. Dalby stated her concern with the lack of a thorough contact tracing protocol. The district nurse confirmed that students are getting tested but still attending school while waiting for results, and the results can take up to 5 days. On Tuesday afternoon, Oroville City Council met with the main agenda item being a discussion of the proposed village at Ruddy Creek subdivision that would be located at Feather Avenue and 18th Street in Thermalito. The proposal would include annexing the subdivision into the city limits. It would also include a general plan amendment and a zoning amendment. The annexation of this county land is already making its way through the Butte County Local Agency Formation Commission, or LAFCO. The project would include 97 single-family houses on 24 acres. About 20 acres would be home sites, and 4 acres would be dedicated to community parks. This subdivision had been approved by the Oroville City Council back in 2007 with more density, but work was halted with the recession. The approval then expired in 2012. After much discussion, including hearing concerns from members of the public about flooding in the area, as well as concerns about the subsidies given to the landowners from the city, the council ultimately approved the project, with council members Linda Draper and Janet Goodson voting against the project. I spoke with council member Draper and asked her why she voted against the project.
Well, I realize that this has been in the city plan since 2008. Things have changed in many ways since then. And one of them is that they've added many, many more houses out in that area of Thermalito, and there's already a traffic issue. And so they're talking about now putting in 97 homes, and they're thinking that there's going to be one car per home. So I mentioned that in these days, most people have at least two cars at every home. So we're talking about 200 additional vehicles driving out in that area and getting over to the highway or to, you know, the freeway. And so I think there's going to be a really big problem with traffic. The other concern is the flooding. That area has flooded for years, and many of the residents expressed concerns about that, as well as the environmental impact on that creek area. It's not a drainage ditch. The third thing that to me is most significant is that the people that live there do not want to be annexed into the city. And I've received probably well over 50 messages from individuals who live out there in Thermalito, and they do not want this. So to me, the bottom line is, are we going to be representative of what the people want, or are we going to be pushing a project through so that, you know, more taxes can be made off the property, et cetera? And so I feel like it's ill-advised because of the increased traffic and the flooding, but I also feel it's a slap in the face to the many people who live out there who chose to live outside the city limits, and now they are being annexed against their wishes.
Linda Draper, this was your last voting meeting. You will be off the council because you did not run for re-election, and I'm wondering if you have any advice for the council as they move ahead with this project.
My advice to the council going forward would be to really listen and listen to the concerns of constituents and not just push things through without taking that into account. And I feel that the most important thing is that we listen to people. And I did not get one letter in favor of that annexation, not one. But I got well over 50 from 50 different individuals that were against it, but it didn't seem to faze those who voted in favor of it.
That was Oroville City Council member Linda Draper. That was her last voting meeting. She did not run for re-election, and her term is up in January. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Butte Report on KZFR Radio. We'll be right back with more news and information about your local government. The Oroville City Elementary School Board of Trustees also met on Tuesday, and including the swearing-in of Sandra Barnes, who won re-election, and the swearing-in of new members, Jessica Anthony and Sharon Nilsson. Sandra Barnes was elected to be the board president and Pamela Hamilton as the vice president. The main issue for this meeting was a discussion on how to open the schools safely after the new year. I spoke with board member Sharon Nilsson about that discussion and started by asking her to give an overview of the impact of the coronavirus on the Oroville Elementary School District.
Prior to Thanksgiving, we only had a couple of cases, and really they weren't very concerned. But just in the last week post-Thanksgiving, around the county, the district has seen an incredible surge of cases. In fact, at least 300 students are in quarantine right now, 23 staff members. There have been 7 confirmed cases of COVID. But really, the entire 7th grade at one of our middle schools is quarantined right now. And the cases then also span across all of our schools throughout the district. It's very concerning right now, the rate that it is spreading with our students and staff just over the past week.
And so in a way to address the rise in cases, Superintendent Holtum shared the recommendation that came from the district nurse that distance learning should continue after the holidays all the way to January 19th, and that was presented to you all. But through the discussion of the board, distance learning would take place between January 4th and the 11th, not to the 19th, and then the board would hold a special meeting on whether or not to extend that date. Sharon Nilsson, what are your thoughts about that discussion and the decision or the recommendation that the board gave to the superintendent?
Well, I'm very concerned about having our students return to in-person too soon. I mean, we've seen such a huge surge in the county after Thanksgiving. It's only going to be exponentially higher after Christmas, New Year's, after Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, that there's too many celebrations and gatherings, too many people in our communities that aren't following the stay-at-home recommendations, that we're going to see an even larger surge or a surge upon a surge, that it's not going to be safe for our students to return, for our staff to return to the classrooms before the 19th, if even at that time. I definitely was supporting until the 19th. But the other board members requested it to be shortened by a week and to revisit it the first week of January to see where we're at. I know where we're going to be at. I know it's going to be bad. The cases are not going to be low enough or under control enough for us to feel comfortable having students and staff face-to-face, in person, in a classroom. It's just not realistic. It's not smart. It's not safe. So I'm glad that we at least have the caveat that we will be able to meet as a board the first week of January to reassess the plan to return on the 11th and potentially extend the stay-at-home distance learning portion of school.
The issue really comes down to how do we balance the quality in-person education with safety of students and teachers and the staff. And in the conversation, in the meeting on Tuesday night, there was even a discussion about how do we make up for what may be a lost year of education for so many of these students because of these struggles. I know that this is way far in the distance because we're still getting through the pandemic, but how do you see it? How do we balance that safety and good quality education at this time?
You know, we all agree that kids need to be in school and they deserve high quality education. There's no questioning that. The question is, do we compromise the safety and health of our students and staff in order to meet that? And I don't think we should. I think we need to prioritize the health and safety of our students and staff. It's more important that our children and teachers and other school staff their health is protected, that we can protect them as much as possible by not having them interact face-to-face with other individuals. I know that our students are going to be behind. That's everywhere. It's not just our district. It's not just our county. That's across the nation. It's across the globe that we're going to have a year of students that really didn't get the quality education that they deserve, that they're going to be behind. And we're going to all have to figure out how do we mitigate that? How do we help our students get back on track for next year? But it's not something we have to figure out alone. we're not in a bubble with this. This is something that we can figure out together as a nation. Groups of educators can come together and come up with ideas to help us get a jump start when we're ready to be back in class full time, face to face, hopefully by the fall. But that all depends on the numbers of cases and the resurgence and how the vaccine gets out. There's still a lot of questions that we need to take care of first before we figure out how we're going to get our students back on track.
I want to shift just a little bit. I know that you all did not discuss at the Tuesday meeting, but I do want to ask you about the U.S. Department of Justice investigation that really came to light. The results came to light over the summer, and that investigation revealed that African American, Native American, and disabled students were being discriminated against in the Oroville Elementary School District and the Oroville High School District. And the Department of Justice and the California Attorney General reached a settlement, and it incorporates a 5-year plan with the help of state monitors and proper training to school staff members. As part of the 5-year plan laid out in that settlement, both of the school districts must engage the school community about policy changes and improve the handling of student complaints. Sharon Nilsson, the question for you is, what is the status of creating that 5-year plan that could address the discrimination against these particular groups of students?
Well, it is something definitely the district has already started working on, because it is mandated by the state that they take significant corrective action, and they didn't have the luxury of waiting and creating a plan and determining for future dates that they would start making changes. So they have actively started working on professional development with teachers and staff. They've worked on making some changes to some of their policies. I still have a lot to learn, and I'm looking forward to meeting with the superintendent to learn more about what their specific plan is. As far as I know, it hasn't been presented to the public yet, so I need to get that information and find out what is shareable and what is not. But I know that that they want to follow the protocol. They want to work with the state, and they want to do what is required of them. So they have been actively working with their mentor that has been assigned to them, and working towards changing the culture so that all students are included and all students are treated justly. I'm hoping to see larger changes. I know that there are some very specific items that the Department of Justice is requiring of them, but I'm hoping that we can take this as an opportunity to really grow and make more significant changes than just the bare minimum. And so that is something that I will present to the board and hopefully make some positive changes in that area. I know that I understand that they have put together a supportive climate committee with community representatives from local agencies. I'm not sure what the specific purpose of that committee is, so I'm hoping to find out more about that. I know that they have more professional development on the horizon. I'd like to find out more of the details of what that's about. And really what I'd like to see is that they're bringing in people of color to help lead some of that professional development as well. We need to bring in people to do these trainings that have a deeper understanding of the barriers that disadvantage and marginalize our underrepresented students. There's much more work that can be done, and I would like to be an active part of that. So even though it wasn't addressed at this staff meeting, one of my main goals is to get as much information on that as early as possible, and hopefully at the very next staff meeting or next board meeting, we'll be able to get more information on that and find out how much more we can add to the plan to provide the best resources to our staff and our teachers in the school districts, so that we can call out racism, that we can learn to be anti-racist rather than just not being racist. We need to learn to identify racism and actively fight against it. And we need to get better at identifying forms of bias and microaggressions and learn how to respond appropriately. So it's going to be a process, and I understand now why they need 5 years to do this. But I'm optimistic that the district is willing to make some changes and work with their mentor and work towards with the community towards making these changes.
That was Sharon Nielsen, member of the Oroville Elementary School Board of Trustees. When we return, we will talk about the Chico City Council meeting and hear from Chico City Council member Alex Brown about the council's discussion of the cannabis issue. This is Sue Hildebrand. You're listening to the Butte Report on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. Turning to Chico, in a media alert sent on Wednesday, the city announced that an emergency warming center will be made available until Friday morning at 8 a.m. The warming center is located at Depot Park on 5th and Cedar Streets in Chico and open from 5 p.m. until 8 a.m. The warming center is a tent structure with lighting and heating for those seeking respite from the cold. Personal belongings must remain outside of the tent area, and pets must remain leashed at all times. Due to COVID-19, masks will be required in the warming center. The emergency warming center is activated where weather forecasts show the temperature falling below 32 degrees with no precipitation. Additional criteria include the temperature at or below 45 degrees with anticipated precipitation of 3/4 of an inch or more. Criteria also include temperature at or below 40 degrees where anticipated wind speeds average 15 or more miles per hour. At the Chico City Council meeting on Tuesday, many items that had already been voted on in the past were brought back for review by the new majority on the council. At the request of Vice Mayor Casey Reynolds at the December 8th council meeting, the City Council re-examined police staffing positions that were frozen back in the spring due to potential COVID-19 budget restrictions. The council voted 6-1 to pass a motion to unfreeze police department positions, including animal control, dispatch, and sworn park ranger positions. At the request of council member Cammie Denley, the council discussed the possibility of banning syringe services programs, also known as needle distribution programs, within the city of Chico. The council voted 5-2 to pass a motion directing the city attorney to find any and all legal means to ban this type of program within the city limits. For background, the California Department of Public Health authorized the Chico-based nonprofit organization North Valley Harm Reduction Coalition to administer a syringe services program to address the rising cases of HIV and hepatitis C in Butte County. The city of Chico was not involved in the program, nor did it have any authority to begin or end the program. However, the program was ended after the state and the nonprofit were sued based on the fact that an environmental review had not been conducted to assess the impact of the program on the environment. When asked if a city ban could actually trump a state-authorized program, the city attorney said he was unsure of the answer, but would research and bring it back to council. Next, at the request of Councilmember Sean Morgan, who wanted to reconsider his yes vote on the establishment of new fees for the commercial cannabis program, that vote took place during a regular council meeting on October 20th. After some discussion, council voted unanimously to pass a motion directing city staff to pause the application process for the program so city staff could have time to bring back a future discussion of options to enhance the fee structure of the cannabis program for council to consider. On Wednesday, I spoke with council member Alex Brown about what this action may mean for the sale of commercial cannabis. Brown had chaired the Commercial Cannabis Advisory Committee, which consisted of an array of community stakeholders. After months of meeting, the committee produced a comprehensive program to allow and regulate commercial cannabis activities, including the rules establishing business permits for businesses, how permit applicants will be selected, and land use regulations. The entire package was approved by the council in August, paving the way for commercial cannabis sales in Chico. I started by asking Brown to explain what was included in the package of rules and regulations pertaining to the sale of cannabis.
Yeah, so it was a pretty comprehensive package of rules and regulations that went through a lot of vetting, not only by council and the Internal Affairs Committee, but by the community, by the Planning Commission, et cetera. And essentially, it's hard to boil down to a short synopsis, but we voted to allow four retail dispensaries to be dispersed through the city. We voted to allow an unlimited number of deliveries and to allow the market to take care of itself on that. We voted to allow distribution, manufacturing, and testing facilities to exist within city limits. And we voted not to allow any form of cultivation within the city limits. So there's some permitting differences between those different types of businesses. Obviously, for retail cannabis dispensaries and deliveries, there's a little bit more to the process. They have to apply for a conditional use permit, and so there's an extra layer of vetting there.
And all of this was passed by the council back in August. Last month, on November 3rd, the city council passed a fee schedule for commercial cannabis businesses, which would basically finalize the application process for businesses. However, this past Tuesday in the council meeting, the new council voted to pause the program so that the fee schedule can be reassessed in terms of cost recovery. What does this mean for business owners who have been waiting for the application process to begin?
The approved fee schedule was specifically for recovering the cost of processing those applications and getting those businesses started. The vote that was taken last night was a reconsideration by Councilmember Morgan, who had voted yes on the fee schedule, which is on the previous meeting's consent agenda. And his synopsis was that until we have a conversation about sales tax or revenue generation, that we shouldn't be moving forward with accepting applications. Last night, through this discussion, some information was requested of staff to come back with information about sales tax measures and to discuss the possibility of development agreements instead of conditional use permits. Development agreements allow a little bit more flexibility in terms of the types of fees that you can impose on a business that's operating. So what ended up happening was we had one application for a retail cannabis dispensary in the queue, and the council voted to allow that applicant to either accept a refund and rescind their application or to keep their application in the running along with their fees. But the vote that was taken was essentially to pause and delay until we have more information about the revenue-generating measures.
Councilmember Alex Brown, it seems that the original fee schedule was simply to recover costs, and it seems that the discussion the other night was about money generation. Is that a shift in focus?
It's not a shift in focus. It's an interesting shift in timing. We always knew that a sales tax measure would be an ideal next step for generating revenue. And as all members of the council know, any kind of revenue generating measure in the form of a tax would have to be voted on by the people. We weren't able to do that in the last election cycle because we had already planned on having a sales tax measure, a general sales tax measure on the ballot. That obviously didn't come to fruition. But putting two sales tax measures on a ballot actually decreases the likelihood of both of them passing. So this really is an appropriate time to discuss a sales tax measure. And, you know, my belief is that you can do that while accepting applications and moving forward with the process, because that application process takes a lot of time.
And you have been deeply involved in pushing this issue forward. So you really know the ins and outs of this effort. Given the decision by the council on Tuesday to pause this application process and reassess, do you have any sort of estimate for when the process will be resumed?
My hope would be as soon as possible. We've already done this much work to get to this place. But given some of the comments made, I do have some concern that it's going to be delayed, you know, pretty indefinitely. Yesterday, a motion was made to go back to, quote, only essential business for council meetings starting in January. And so, you know, previously when we had done that, we weren't discussing cannabis. And so it would stand to reason that we would be delaying further conversation on a sales tax measure or development agreements until non-essential business is kind of brought back into the council chambers. And my belief, based on the motion that was made last night, is that until people are allowed back into chambers, that's going to be the case. obviously COVID-19 has this indefinite reality attached to it, and so I don't see that happening until COVID-19 is more under control.
That was Chico City Council Member Alex Brown. The next regular City Council meeting will be Tuesday, January 5th at 6 p.m. in the Chico City Council Chambers. You can also watch the